Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, where we cover trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world, our communities, and bring them a mental health perspective.
Hi, I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and today I'm joined by Brandon Johnson. Brandon's a proud graduate of Morgan State University and also a graduate of John Hopkins School of Professional Health. Brandon is a public health practitioner and has worked in the field of mental health suicide prevention for the past 7 years. Brandon joins us not only as an expert in suicide prevention, but as an advocate for Black mental health, as our podcast today is talking about his work with oppression and race and the intersection with mental health. Brandon, it's so nice to have you with us today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Nice to have you. Thank you again. Well, you know, in setting up our time together, Brandon, we know that witnessing an injustice or violence against someone in our community can be very traumatizing and invoke just a myriad of feelings, including anxiety and stress, feelings of desperation, hopelessness, sadness, rage, anger. All of these feelings are things that we notice surfacing when we see these things. And we've seen a handful of recent events in our nation that have revealed injustices that do in fact occur, as well as the psychological and the societal and actually even the national sequelae that really are the consequences of these events. So as we're talking about oppression, let's just kind of start at the very beginning, setting kind of a cornerstone understanding. When we're talking about oppression, what are we really focusing on? Can you define that for us in a way that can be kind of a working focus for us today?
Sure. Oppression really, and I'm going to give kind of the dictionary definition and then talk about it in practice, but oppression really is prolonged, cruel, or unjust treatment or control. And I do want to talk about that treatment or control. And another definition is mental pressure or distress. And so when we talk about oppression is really centered on the control of another group of people. And so in order for oppression to take place, the group of people that is doing the oppressing has to have levels and multiple levels of power, multiple levels of control to be able to influence and enact it on another group of people. So really, when we talk about oppression, we're talking about a power structure.
Right. So there really has to be a power differential between these groups where there is a vulnerability for control, for exploitation, for someone really to be suffering potentially.
Absolutely. So, you know, we can see this in a number of things. We talk about what's happening currently right now after the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. And this is really the context of what's happening now in our country. We've seen this play out, honestly, too many times. And as we look at this, we've had people talk about oppression and talk about how it's played out in law enforcement in their interactions with people of color. And also, you know, it goes beyond that. We've seen this oppression take place in healthcare and in mental health care and in discriminatory practices and in housing and in financial situations where, you know, again, we talk about power systems where financial institutions are able to provide funding and loans to one group versus others. We've also seen it, you know, as well in research across a number of fields, including mental health, where we see a lot of interventions and randomized control trials and those things take place where it isn't representative of the overall population or of certain groups of people. And then once those studies are done, they're considered best practices. However, they haven't been tested or worked out in multiple groups of people. So we're focusing a lot, like, and right now the attention is really on law enforcement interaction, but oppression really develops and shows itself in a number of different avenues.
I get that. When you're talking about the oppression, the racism that occurs, and you're talking about the most recent events, it does raise our awareness one more time. It's not the first time it's been raised, but it's being raised one more time. How has the awareness of oppression and racism been changing over time, have you found?
So for me, I think the awareness has been increasing. I think that we've been seeing a lot of what's happening. And I think one of the interesting things about watching the progression of the awareness of oppression and racism is that there was a season, once we kind of got past the civil rights movement And there were some laws put in place to protect people of color against certain discriminatory practices, that there was this time period where it felt like things had progressed to the point that racism had kind of gone away or dramatically reduced. And then in these situations that we find ourselves in now, where we watch what's happening across the country, we're reminded that it hasn't gone away. It's really just changed. And so the view of it has changed. How it happens has changed. And so it's different. And so things are less overt, more covert. And with the ability for us to record any conversation in an instant has definitely provided some ability to get people to become reaware that this hasn't gone away. It's still happening. It's still here. It's still ever present.
Right. You know, you're talking about something that just doesn't go away. We're talking about something that is trauma-based, that is deeply etched in the fabric of and in the psyche of who we are as a nation, the various races. And you're also talking about the awareness that we, at this season of these things reemerging, we get to make more and more conscious and increase a mindfulness around. You know, when I think about the work I do, whether it's in my practice with individuals or with couples, you know, it's about making the unconscious conscious. It's about taking those things that we do without real awareness or understanding at times and trying to make ourselves aware and, again, mindful of the things that we're doing. And it feels to me like as much systemic change as we need to take a look at and how that can be implemented, my sense, and I'd be curious about your sense, is that that work really needs to first start within.
Absolutely.
And asking some of the questions that we hold before the between work. So if I'm working with a couple, before they can do the between work in the marriage, I've got to work within each one of them individually first so they can develop an awareness, an understanding. And that understanding, more times than not, takes a look at what is their family history? What are the earliest influences? What memories do they hold? What kind of beliefs have they set? Knowing the unknown, I mean, most of us are walking around unconscious, just doing what we know. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about here that I really like, it's the same kind of work racially, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it's the same kind of work around what do I hold about justice and what do I hold about kind of power differential that we may not even know we could be a part of. So this idea of doing the within work first before the between work can happen and real change, ideally this time around, can occur, it has to start there. Otherwise, things will be sustainable. We'll have this conversation 5 years from now or the next time some awful incident happens. And so you're talking about this awareness maybe being able to occur at a number of levels. Give me your thoughts on that.
I completely agree with what you're saying. And it does. It takes a level of introspection to really challenge ourselves and to have those. We often talk about courageous conversations happening interpersonally, but also they need to happen internally. There are a ton of things around implicit bias and around microaggressions. So those small interactions between people that really tends to put people down and can be subtle forms of racism. It really does take a lot of introspection and work. There are a bunch of anti-racism resources out there that are available to people to kind of have that conversation. There's so many beliefs and things that we grow up with, and we may not necessarily get the full picture of them in that time, but when we take the time and make an intentional effort to unpack what some of those things were, where some of our beliefs come from, and what they are and how they could be in a larger social context. And so I think people innately think of themselves as good, and the way that they brought up was good, and the things that they think and feel are good, but thinking about them in a larger context of, you know, how does this come off with a person of color or in a different situation? You know, why is it that, you know, if I'm, you know, walking somewhere and someone, you know, African-American male is walking towards me, why do I move over more? Why do I try to make sure my valuables are safe? Like, what are those things? Like, what's happening? Like, what's the deeper part of that? Like, why are these things happening? And once we can unpack that, we can have those conversations with ourselves and then begin to find ways to heal from that and change behavior. And I think that's where we really get to systemic change, because if people won't fix what they don't think is a problem.
That's right. I love that piece right there, because what you're posing here, and I would love for this show to hold up today, is what if we gave ourselves an invitation individually and collectively to take a look at what, you know, could be this kind of collective unconscious that we all are kind of holding individually in our own race or ethnicity or as a nation? What is that that's there? And what are the origins of some of our beliefs, our behavior patterns that come out of that? And this idea that if we do not, things aren't going to change and things will only get worse. At this point, when you notice and you talk about the impact of oppression and racism, what's the impact on the mental health that you're seeing in your position as an advocate, as a suicide expert? What are you witnessing?
That's an important question. There's so many different things that we've seen in literature and that we've seen in real practice and in my space. And so you touched on some of them earlier, but there is increased anxiety that develops as a part of this racism and discrimination. There's really something challenging about seeing someone who looks like you being murdered. Like having the videotape of that and watching it play over oftentimes in the media is challenging. So there are feelings of anxiety and feelings of being unsafe. People of color experience disproportional PTSD symptoms as a result of racism and discrimination. And this goes down to repeated microaggressions into large traumatizing experiences on the job or losing a job or challenging experiences with law enforcement. So it varies, but it really doesn't matter on the level of the discrimination and racism. The frequency of it and how we internalize it becomes a part of us and really gives us those feelings of apprehension, of not feeling safe and feeling anxious and constantly having fight or flight trigger within us is another part of that. And so we see those things come up, and there is also a lack of trust. And in seeing those things in history play out in healthcare and mental health care has definitely impacted help-seeking behaviors. And going to regular checkups or finding a therapist, there have been things in history that have really challenged us to be leery of some of these systems. So that has long-term impact as well. African Americans experience disproportionately more trauma than other racial ethnic groups, aside from American Indian and Alaska Natives, but we have one of the lowest help-seeking behavior percentages of psychiatric positions of anybody in the country. So what we're seeing is like we are traumatized and have experienced these things, but they have also, because of how the systems are set up and how, again, we've talked about how different studies have looked at particularly groups that aren't people of color, many of our psychiatric therapeutic strategies are also have been created the same way. And so when people find them and they're not helpful and they go to seek help with their mental health challenges and aren't met with someone that looks like them or someone who can portray cultural humility, we're less likely to go back. So we're experiencing the trauma and not getting the care. We've also been seeing this play out in, you know, suicidal attempt and ideation. There have been multiple studies that have looked at challenges around race and discrimination and people experiencing more suicidal ideation as a result of that, because of the hopelessness that comes from it. We've talked about how much we've been battling and dealing with this issue over many, many years. And so what a person can internalize is that this may be a hopeless topic. This may be something that we have to deal with for quite some time. And so that can bring a level of hopelessness as well. That is a risk factor for suicidal ideation.
We're talking about the impact and the very truth-based takeaway from this trauma-based history and all the rippling effects that it's had. If you're comfortable, tell me a story about yourself. I would love to kind of anchor part of this talk and maybe something you've experienced that might really just accentuate these points that you're highlighting for us right now. Would you be willing?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think I'll go with one in particular. So as you said, I graduated from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It's number one public health school in the country. I always plug that because I love my school.
There we go.
And so as a part of that, you know, you get out and you feel like you're going to take over the world and you kind of are gung-ho about that. I was working at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing really since high school. I was there as administrative, as an intern, and graduated from Morgan and got a job there, and it was a great and inclusive space. I love the people there. It was awesome. I still love them to this day. I have connections with all of them. And so my first job out of that was at a local health department. I can't remember what that first position was, but the lead, the health director, had gotten my resume and said, I want him in another capacity. And so as a part of that, I was contractual working with her on some different projects and working with our local health improvement coalition. I became a community engagement coordinator during that time. It was a really, really great experience. And so the health director, she was the first Black health director in that county. There had never been one before. She came from Africa and moved over here, gotten her degree. She was a doctor. And so there she hired myself. She hired another doctor who was African-American. She hired a bunch of other people as well. And so long story short, what began to happen was that there was some feelings that she had hired some of the African-American staff unfairly, that they, you know, didn't have their credentials or didn't go through the proper process, and they challenged her. And so during this time, people were making fun of her name because it was African. It was difficult to pronounce. And so people were making some really terrible jokes about that. People were also undermining her, and people were openly defying in meetings, you know, and it was really a challenging thing to witness. And so, and then knowing that, you know, you got hired on your scale, your merit, like my, you know, my resume, I had done, like I said, I was working at Hopkins. I was leading multiple research studies on the intersection of intimate partner violence and mental health and home nursing visitation. I mean, I was doing some really good stuff. I had multiple degrees, and, you know, for people to feel like I wasn't worthy enough to be in that position was damaging. And so ultimately, a lot of the staff who was predominantly white, did eventually get her fired. Like, they put up so many different things that they felt were unfair, that she wasn't competent enough to do her job. I mean, really toxic things. And so because I was contractual, she was going to put me into a permanent position when one opened up. She wasn't able to do that. And so I was let go at the end of my contract. And so I had my son at the time. He was 2, and it was tough. It was a really tough time. And so my mental health wasn't the best during that time. You know, I felt feelings of inadequacy. I felt like maybe I wasn't good enough. Even though I worked with everyone else, I knew my job. I knew the skill set that I had, but just because of, you know, my skin, it was looked down upon. And ultimately, it propelled me into my former position where I was director of suicide and violence prevention for the state of Maryland. So it propelled me into a great position and got me into some different work. But it was challenging. I was unemployed for over 7 months, you know, with a 2-year-old. It was challenging, but, you know, ultimately it worked out, but it was a tough season for me. And so, you know, I understand the importance of it and making sure that we have safe spaces to talk and be connected and to be supported when these things happen. My story isn't rare, unfortunately. It happens, and it's a daily thing that happens. And so, you know, it takes a toll. It really takes a toll. And when I get to another position, like, there's this feeling of, you know, like you're nervous. And when I did get to that position, you know, I didn't know who I could trust. There were people that I thought, you know, I built relationships with when I was there that completely tried to undercut what was happening when we were more than qualified. We were talking about 2 doctors, a master's level person with years of experience, you know, to say we weren't qualified really for no reason was incredibly painful.
I can't imagine. I mean, I love the idea where a resiliency, and I love the idea that you use your adversity to kind of propel you to your next. But between the time this all started and the time when you moved on to what sounded like a really great position as well, you had to carry a lot of emotions, a lot of injustice, a lot of unfairness. How does one hold all that?
Yeah.
How does process that?
Yeah, I mean, we talk in the field, especially around bias, around this notion of imposter syndrome, where you feel that you don't belong in a space that you know you belong into because of some of these feelings. And so I had to deal with that for a while. And it really took just confidence. My faith was a big piece of that. Confidence from my friends, my former colleagues, you know, definitely pushed me to think about, and to have that encouragement of, you're qualified, like, you know what you're doing, you've done this stuff, like, you led federally funded studies for a major university, like, these
you literally have to check your narrative,
and
you
need absolutely
to line up with the truth despite what you're being told or bullied into believing otherwise. You really absolutely have to ground yourself in the truth of who you are.
Absolutely. And it takes a while to do it. I wouldn't say it was easy. And then when I got to that new position, I had a really supportive supervisor at that position and, you know, really got the opportunity to do that and to, you know, wrestle with what I knew to be true. And it was life-changing.
So you've had to, in that whole process, there seems to be like three parts as you're talking about. One, at least to me, would be, how do I cope with these things that are surfacing? Mm-hmm. And how do I find a way to successfully navigate these things in the healthiest possible way, despite those things around me being unjust and unfair? The second piece is, how do I take this energy and not become discouraged to the point where I give up or I act it out in other or self-hurtful ways? That was you being propelled in the next position. But there's still these things that you're carrying from that, and that affects and infects your trust going into the next position. So that's one piece. And the other piece is, how do you heal from that? Mm-hmm. There has to be a healing where you let go, not because you're condoning anything, but you can't carry that trauma from that workplace because it's going to affect the things you do. So both the trust piece and the healing piece, give me a minute on that.
Yeah, it took a while for the trust to be built back. And so I can thankfully say I'm surrounded by people who've helped me to do that, from family to friends to colleagues, and finding where your safe space is, especially for people of color. Every space isn't safe. And you'll learn where to go to really find out what people believe and what their belief system is and how to work with that. And I think the other piece of that is, you know, and the healing part is to continue to work in that space and get people to, you know, get people that you can talk to. One of my big things that I tell people, if you're in this space and you experience some of these challenges, one of the things that's helpful for a lot of people that I found really is to get to a place of advocacy. Yeah. So what I do in every place that I've been through since then is that I mentor other people who are going into the public health and the mental health space. And so young professionals of color who are navigating the same spaces that I navigated when I didn't know what to do and didn't know how to feel, I work with them personally to make sure that I can say, like, hey, this is what happens when this happens, or if they get challenged or, you know, have some feelings of doubt because of their color or because of their age or because of their background, that I can help pour into them so that they can have a support system as they're going through. And I think advocacy is a big part of dealing with some of these things. When we feel like, you know, we do have impact, that there's an internal locus of control, that we have control over what's happening, and we can galvanize and work with people to try to change the system or make what's happening easier for someone else to deal with, there's a sense of, you know, control that we can fight this thing. And there's a sense of peace of, like, I can make sure that someone else doesn't go through what I went through.
Right.
And that was a big part of my healing.
That's fantastic. It's kind of a giving forward, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Knowing that you're feeding into and really empowering those coming after you or alongside you to really have a clear perspective of this. Before we close for today, I want to know from you, are there some resources that you'd recommend that we take a look at, can benefit from? Give us a list.
Absolutely. So I'll give a couple. One is the Black Mental Health Alliance. They're a national organization. They are based in Baltimore, where I'm from. And so their website is blackmentalhealth.org. They do a ton in this space. They have a Black Mental Health provider list. They're able to help people connect to a therapist of color. They also do healing circles, which is really something that's based in African-American tradition, where we can talk and process some of our trauma as a collective. And so it works in their storytelling as a part of it. It's evidence-based. It's a really great tool. And so they provide training for those, and they do those in Baltimore and provide training for those elsewhere. So they're a great resource. I also want to mention the Horace L. Henson Foundation. And this was started by actress Taraji P. Henson. And so they are a mental health advocacy group for people of color. And they have been sponsoring free virtual therapy sessions as a part of a response for COVID-19, as African-Americans and other people of color have been disproportionately impacted by that. So they're doing those in waves. And so I believe in another 2 weeks, they're opening up another session where people can register to get free therapy sessions. And it's really, you know, critical for people who haven't experienced therapy for some of the reasons we talked about earlier. It's a great way for people to get back into therapy and be connected that way. And there's another resource, Depressed While Black, but they are centered on storytelling about people with African-American descent who have lived experience in the mental health arena and have different challenges and can speak to, you know, how people of color can navigate it, how they can become a part of it, and how they can do some advocacy work. So those would be three I would mention.
Outstanding. Outstanding. I appreciate that. Brandon, I know we're kind of winding down on our time today. I really appreciate you being with us, and I trust our paths are going to cross again as we continue to navigate this time in our individual lives, in our families, in our communities, and ideally as a nation. I love and I appreciate your invitation for us to start talking, but having the right conversations. You know, Carl Rogers, really a great, most well-known psychotherapist, said, understanding is risky. When you think about it, once we understand ourselves, once I understand you, I'm forever changed. Nothing can any longer be the same. And once I make my unconscious conscious, I can't undo that. And ideally what we get to do with this invitation that you're putting out there and what you're encouraging of us is that we get to take a look at maybe what we've been carrying consciously, unconsciously. And we can do that within work first so that this between work, between us, can begin to change in some really needed and significant ways. So Brandon, I certainly appreciate your time with us today. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on. This has been great.
Our pleasure. Well, to our listeners, thanks for joining us. And we look forward to having you join us on our next podcast with Behavioral Health Today.
Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Triad Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.